assassination of Iran's General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas. Now, the general was the ultimate anti-terror figure in the region, who had been successful in countering Daesh, al-Nusra Front, and other terrorists who had been brought to the region. Stay with us as we talk about the commanders of the resistance to terrorism and hegemony on this debate. As commemoration ceremonies are taking place throughout Iraq, there we have seen commemoration services taking place in Syria, in Lebanon, and now Iraqi people have gathered and have lit candles and, of course, showing their respect for those two brave commanders and others who were killed in that U.S. terrorist attack 1 year ago. A commemoration ceremony in the Iraqi capital for General Soleimani. I'd like to welcome now my guests to the program out of Pittsburgh, author of No More War, Daniel Kovalik, and the director of Rasala Strategic Studies Institute, Dr. Sam Mathitorabi, out of Qom. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start it off with Daniel. Now, Daniel, what we saw take place almost a year ago, from an international legality perspective, we would definitely say illegal, definitely against international law, and yet nothing has been done. It seems even talked about, really, that something was going to be done from the so-called international community. Your assessment of this?
Well, I think the U.S. has effectively destroyed, international law, at least as it applies to the United States. It has undermined its enforcement mechanisms, for example, by sanctioning the International Criminal Court because it wants to investigate U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. has made it clear that it believes it's above the law, and the international community either can't or won't force it to abide by international law. Another example of this, of course, is that the U.S. lost an International Court of Justice case to Iran, I believe it was last 2019, over sanctions. And so the U.S.'s response was to say, well, we're not going to honor this decision. And by the way, we're withdrawing from the International Court of Justice, which is the highest court in the world. So we see time and again that the U.S. Has found a way to evade international law, and sadly, I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Okay, viewers, if you're looking at the live images there, you see, well, you were looking at those images actually from the actual site of where the assassination had taken place last year. That was live images out of Baghdad there, where people had gathered to commemorate. Sam, when we look at the situation and we go back a year ago with Donald Trump basically saying, yes, he ordered the assassination, do you think that there was a miscalculation there? Or why do you think that the United States ordered this assassination to begin with?
Good evening, Nazia.
Good evening.
Well, you know, we have to understand the context of the Syrian war. The Syrian war was the closest thing we've had to a world war since World War II, if you don't count the wars that existed in Africa, which some have also counted as world wars. So in this quasi-world war, you had on the one side the U.S. and its allies, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the NATO countries, Turkey, and of course the Takfiris that they used as their mercenaries and as the, you know, head of the spear, so to speak, to destroy Syria and Iraq. And on the other side, you had the people of Syria, the people of Iraq, the resistance with Iran as its leader, and of course then later Russia joining. After Haj Qasem Soleimani went and personally spoke to Putin about the strategic and historic threat that this issue represents. And in this Syrian war, and in this world war, the result of this war was that the U.S. and its allies were badly defeated. And so when you have the Americans deciding that they're going to assassinate the main commander of this war, because according to everyone, Haj Qasim, was the main commander of this war. He was the one that led the war, especially the ground war. So it seems that this was almost out of spite. This was out of a reaction to having miserably failed in this war, in this world war, having experienced a strategic defeat exactly the way they did in Iraq prior to that, during their own during the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And so, as far as I can tell, this was basically just trying to kill the person who had defeated them.
Well, Daniel, what about that? You heard our guest in Qom say basically it was a reaction because of a strategic defeat. With that being said, then, is it that the United States not only does not care about security in this region, and basically many would say has been behind much of the turmoil, but even in Europe, because we know these same terrorists that caused such havoc in this region also did the same in certain European cities?
Yes. Well, I think that certainly part of what the U.S. wanted to do with the murder of Soleimani was to, as my colleague said, to get retribution against a military commander that had outsmarted them in theaters like Syria. But I also think, and I fear, that another goal of that murder, as well as the recent murder of the nuclear scientist in Iran, is to try to provoke a war with that country. The U.S., particularly under Trump, for the last 2 years, has tried to engage in incredibly provocative actions, hoping that Iran would overreact and give some type of justification for an armed intervention. So far, Iran has shown itself to be very restrained in its responses, very smart in its responses, and has managed to avoid that. I hope it is able to do that in the next 3 weeks, because, you know, there is a lot of noise out there that Trump may be wanting to start a war before he leaves office in 3 weeks.
Okay, Sam, your take on that. Do you think that this was about basically the United States wanting, or as our guest in Pittsburgh said, that Trump wants to start a war with Iran, or is it something else?
Well, let's first see if he leaves office in 3 weeks. That's still a question, number one. So that's the first thing. The other thing is, and we talked about this with my colleague the last time we were on the debate together, which is that from the Iranian perspective, a U.S. attack is actually strategically beneficial to Iran. It allows Iran, it gives Iran the moral legitimacy and the legal right to take military action against all U.S. interests in the region, and to expel the U.S. from the region, from West Asia. So this is something that the generals in the Pentagon know. And, you know, one of the interesting things, and this is something that our viewers should know, the main group in the U.S. who is against the war with Iran is the Pentagon, because the Pentagon knows that they would lose such a war. So whether it was the Bush Jr., or whether it was now Trump, or any other president who was saber-rattling and was thinking about starting a war with Iran, it is always the Pentagon and the military leadership that prevents these U.S. presidents from actually launching a war against Iran, because a war against Iran would actually be the end of U.S. presence in West Asia. And the end of U.S. presence in West Asia basically ends U.S. global, any sort of attempt by the U.S. to maintain global hegemony. And this is something that comes out of these statements and the analysis of the Americans themselves. This is not, you know, my analysis or some sort of a claim. This is something that if you look at the literature by U.S. strategists over the last 70 years, particularly after they became the inheritors of the British in the region and in the world, they inherited the British Empire after World War II. One of the central claims and one of the central issues is having control over West Asia. So for the U.S., it always weighs between losing its position in West Asia and attacking Iran. And so far in these 40 years, it has chosen not to attack Iran directly. It has always done it through proxy, whether it was with Saddam during the 8-year imposed war, or whether it's, you know, through other forces, terrorism or economic war or psychological, whatever, all these sanctions and wars that we've experienced over the 40 years. But it knows very well, when I mean it knows, I mean the Pentagon, and I mean those who actually know war. Mm-hmm. They know that if they engage in a direct war with Iran, it would be the end of U.S. presence in West Asia, and it would be the end of U.S. hegemony in the world.
What about Daniel? When we look at this assassination and the goal behind it, many would say that probably the United States wanted to have a devastating effect on the resistance, and what experts are saying, especially in this region and beyond, is that they have not only stopped the resistance, but actually it is more fervent than ever because of that assassination. Would you say that the United States miscalculated or not by making that move, that the situation has actually gotten worse for Americans in the region?
It may have miscalculated. On the one score that, as you say, I think the resistance, particularly in Iraq, to U.S. presence has now grown. It was right after that that the Iraqi government made it very clear it wanted the U.S. to leave. And the Iraq continues to want the U.S. to leave. And I guess the other miscalculation is, if I'm right, that they wanted to draw Iran into a greater conflict, that they were unable to do that with the murder of Soleimani because Iran did not overreact. So in two different ways, I would say the U.S. miscalculated.
Well, Sam, how much of this, if you look at what the U.S. had claimed throughout the years, that they were actually fighting Daesh and fighting terrorism in the region, and then, of course, then they kill the ultimate anti-terror commander in the region, do you think that actually that facade was taken away for those who still believe that the U.S. was actually fighting against Daesh, or how do you see it?
Well, actually, Trump was the one that tore down the facade. He did it during the elections 2016, where he talked about the Americans sponsoring Daesh through the Saudis and the Turks. And also, the interesting thing is this, that when you have you actually have Trump, when he becomes the president, talking about, he actually said it, he said, we will let the Iranians and the Russians beat Daesh, and then we'll take on the Iranians. He literally said that. So it was clear from the beginning that the Americans in the Trump administration were waiting for Daesh to be taken care of by the Iranians and by the Syrian people and by the Iraqi people and the Russians and the resistance forces. And then after that, they were going to go after the Iranians. Now, you've mentioned a couple times the word miscalculation. Well, the entire U.S. approach to Iran over the last 40 years has been a miscalculation. It's based on false information. It's based on propaganda by Iranian exile groups who have no idea what's going on in Iran. It's based on the delusions and illusions that exist in Tel Aviv and Riyadh and Abu Dhabi about Iran. And it's basically a closed bubble in which people talk to each to themselves and suggest policies and act on policies and implement policies which have no connection to the reality of what Iran is.
Why is that the case? Almost 42 years later, since the victory of the revolution in Iran, why are they still miscalculating when it comes to dealing with the Islamic Republic?
Well, first of all, let's not say that that's a bad thing. You know, it's a good thing that they don't understand us. And if they want to continue not to understand us, that's fine with us. The point is that they come from a background which is an imperial background. It's not the imperial background of the British, where they would directly come and take over a country, but they are the inheritors of the British Empire in this region, and they claim to be the hegemon and they have the right to do anything they want in this region. And the most important aspect of their strategy in the region is to not allow governments that are based on the will of the people. So if you look at Saudi Arabia and all these, states in the southern Persian Gulf, they are medieval, family dictatorships. If you look at Israel, it is an apartheid state in which a minority is occupying a majority. And so for the first time in the region, you have a country like Iran, who has a popular revolution that establishes a republic based on a written constitution. You know, Saudi Arabia doesn't have a written constitution. Israel doesn't have a written constitution. It has the Westminster system. And so you have a state in the Islamic Republic whose leadership and whose system is based on the will of the people. So this is the root of why the Americans can never come to terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. because Iran is an independent country, and its power is based on the people.
Stay with me. Well, Daniel, what about that? Sam talked about the will of the people, and actually, after the assassination of General Soleimani, we saw millions of people taking to the streets, not only in Iran, but in Iraq, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Syria, actually mourning what had happened and promising that they would seek revenge and that they would be united in their demand that the United States must leave West Asia. Your take on all of this, because it seems that by actually this terrorist attack that the United States committed, that they increased the solidarity of the people in the region and their determination to make sure that the U.S. leaves this region.
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, General Soleimani was a very popular figure, not only in Iran, but in Iraq as well, in Syria as well. It seems to me that they picked the wrong person to go after there. They delegitimized themselves. Again, they didn't get Iran to react in a way that provoked a major conflict. They clearly overshot the mark on this one. And I think the U.S. will pay for this for a long time, because I think the region will continue to reject the United States' presence there. And I think this assassination, as you say, only increases that resolve.
And Sam Mehdi, your take. I mean, we saw after the assassination, we saw little kids actually in the streets here in Iran saying, "I am Qasem Soleimani." That basically young people are saying that they will continue his way. The legacy that he's left behind, and where do you see as far as the resistance going from here?
Well, let's just be clear that there's no American kid saying that, you know, "I am General Petraeus." There's no Israeli kid, you know, saying, "I am General, you know, whatever the latest murderer from Israel is." So the reality is that we have people like Haj Qasem, like Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. These are people who worked on themselves for an entire lifetime as a spiritual matter. I think the most interesting aspect of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi's life is their spiritual life. Of course, you know, this is not the place to maybe discuss it, or maybe we can talk about it at some other forum. But that's the reality we have in these people who are deeply spiritual people. They are not, you know, Wall Street weapons lobby generals who have to, you know, resign from the CIA because they had an affair with their mistress. These are not people who are revolving door generals who, you know, go and fight in Iraq and then become lobbyists for the weapons industry and then now are becoming defense secretary. So it's a completely different worldview and model of how a human being has to live, how a commander and a general and a soldier lives, and it is something that's completely lost in the West. They don't have it anymore. There might have been something close to that when you look at people like General Marshall, you know, who from the famous Marshall Plan, and you know, who spent almost 60 years of his life in service. And when he was asked at the end of his life, you know, "Will you write a memoir?" He said, "I don't want to profit privately from my public service." Can you imagine a U.S. general saying this today? So this is the thing. We shouldn't assume that because they both have uniforms, we're talking about the same species. These are two different species, and this is the point about General Soleimani, and this is why he was so popular, and this is why he's a hero across the world, not just in this region, but across the world.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. Sorry, we're out of time. Author of No More War, Daniel Kovalik out of Pittsburgh, and director of Risalat Strategic Institute, Sam Mehdi Torabi out of Qom. Appreciate both of you being with us. And as always, we appreciate you staying with us on another debate. Bye-bye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فالذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات لهم مغفرة.
And those who have believed and done righteous deeds, for them is forgiveness and noble provision. But the ones who strove against our verses, seeking to cause failure, those are the companions of hellfire.
Dear listeners, we were talking about the 50th verse of the chapter. فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَهُمْ مَغْفِرَةٌ وَرِزْقٌ كَرِيمٌ. Then those who believe and do righteous deeds, for them is forgiveness and an honorable sustenance. The 51st verse also says, وَالَّذِينَ سَعَوْا فِي آيَاتِنَا مُعَاجِزِينَ أُولَٰئِكَ أَصْحَابُ الْجَحِيمِ. And those who strive against our signs, they shall be the inhabitants of hell. So about the verse فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ, we said that after the 49th verse, at first the Holy Quran starts talking about the glad tidings, فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ, and in the 51st verse, it starts talking about the punishments and chastisements of those people who are trying to reject the signs of the Almighty Allah. Anyway, we were on to the 50th verse. فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ, those who believe and do righteous deeds. So these two things together, being from among the believers and having the righteous deeds, these two things are conditions of this blessing that the verse is mentioning, مَغْفِرَةٌ وَرِزْقٌ كَرِيمٌ. If you want to achieve مَغْفِرَةٌ, if you want to achieve forgiveness, and رِزْقٌ كَرِيمٌ, honorable sustenance, you have to have these two things accompanying each other, being from the people of Iman, and also having عَمَلْ صَالِحٌ. And it is really interesting that in this verse, at first it says مَغْفِرَةٌ, which is a kind of moral and spiritual blessing, and then it says رِزْقٌ كَرِيمٌ, which at the first glance is talking about materialistic sustenance, but of course an honorable kind. And it is somehow denoting that if you have got sustenance, you have to accompany it with تَكْرِيمٌ, with generosity, or as we said in the previous program, something more than generosity.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In
this
series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
In the previous program, we talked about the word Rizqun Kareem, and we mentioned that Raqib in his book says that it is applied for some good and worthy that are very considerable. But some commentators have meant the Quranic phrase Rizqun Kareem as a kind of ceaseless sustenance without blemish, and some others have said it means as a worthy sustenance, which are all inside that consistent and universal meaning that is the worthy and considerable things. The 51st verse says, وَالَّذِينَ سَعَوْا فِي آيَاتِنَا مُعَاجِزِينَ, and those who strive against our signs, أولئك أصحاب الجحيم, they shall be the inhabitants of hell. So the verse is talking about those pagans who were striving and doing their best to stop the people from getting and reaching the truth, and they had nothing else to say. They just strive against the signs of the Almighty Allah. They were trying to reject the signs of the Almighty Allah, but none can stop the Almighty Allah's objects, and it is implying that those who try to ruin the verses of Allah or wanted to wipe them out imagined that they could overcome the assured will of Allah, but they are the dwellers of hellfire. وَالَّذِينَ سَعَوْا فِي آيَاتِنَا مُعَاجِزِينَ, those who strive against our signs, which means to reject them, أُولَٰئِكَ أَصْحَابُ الْجَحِيمِ, they shall be the inhabitants of hell. The Arabic word sa'u is derived from sa'i, which originally means to run, and here it means efforts and endeavors in the way of ruining and wasting the verses of the Almighty Allah. Also, the Quranic word mu'ajizin is derived from ajz, which here means someone who wants to overcome the infinite power of Allah. Also, the Quranic word jahim, أُولَٰئِكَ أَصْحَابُ الْجَحِيمِ, the inhabitants of hell, jahim is derived from jahm, which means the violence of the flame of fire. It is also applied for the violence of wrath. So the term jahim is somewhere which has a flaming fire, a fire maybe full of wrath, and here it is referring to hellfire. May the Almighty Allah help us to achieve the right path and continue our lives in the same path. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa
barakatuh. Don't be saddened by what what you see by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The World with Reporters.
People have gathered here in Kabul to pay respect to the bravery and the leading role of two significant figures against invading forces and foreign-backed terrorists, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and our national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud were close friends and comrades in the region. Their sacrifices have not been fully highlighted yet, so we need to know them more than ever.
Given the fact that Afghanistan has been repeatedly invaded by some superpowers, mainly over the past two centuries, resistance is considered a familiar concept among the nation. Afghans have had some top resistance leaders like Ahmad Shah Massoud, a national hero who became the victim of a terrorist attack back in 2001. His characteristics are very much similar to that of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in the eyes of Afghans.
The U.S. expected to remove the name of Qasem Soleimani from the minds of resisting nations by assassinating him. But contrary to those expectations, he became a popular hero, not only for Iranians, but also for all resistance nations across the world, just like Massoud.
Afghans and Iranians share many commonalities in terms of history, culture, religion, and security. Many people here in Afghanistan believe that one of the major similarities between these two nations is their resisting spirit against the invaders. This event in Afghanistan marks the memories of two well-known resistance leaders, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud. This comes as Afghans themselves are suffering from terrorism and are seeking to follow the path of these two heroes. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A year has passed since millions of Iranians attended the funeral service of slain Iranian military figure General Soleimani. Now, on the first anniversary of his assassination by the U.S., his fellow citizens in Kerman have once again come to his burial place to pay respect to him. Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was killed in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from U.S. President Donald Trump.
We strongly demand that the Islamic Republic take harsh revenge. This is the demand made by all Iranians who owe their security to the efforts of General Soleimani in the fight against the terrorists.
General Soleimani is well known as the nemesis of the terrorists in the region. He played a key role in dismantling Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017 and helped liberate major areas in Syria from the terror group. That's what makes everyone question the U.S.'s drive behind his assassination.
General Soleimani brought the U.S. to its knees in the region. The U.S. sought to trigger chaos in our region by creating Daesh, but General Soleimani helped unite the people of the region and foiled Washington's attempts by defeating Daesh.
Following Soleimani's assassination, massive crowds of people in Iraq took part in his funeral service to pay respect to him. This was followed by million-strong processions in Iran, the last of which was held in his hometown before he was laid to rest. Tehran regards General Soleimani as the architect of U.S.'s defeat in the region. His role in dislodging Daesh terrorists won him huge support and popularity, not only among Iranians, but among the people of Syria and Iraq, who say his assassination created a united front against the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Kerman.
Iran has marked the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's PMU commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes. The ceremony was attended by a small group of people from all walks of life and senior officials due to anti-COVID health protocols. Addressing the ceremony, Iran's judiciary chief Ayatollah Raisi has warned the enemies should await Iran's harsh revenge for the killing of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Raisi also said the assassination of anti-terror commander Soleimani will fail to undermine the resistance front.
By assassinating the hero of the fight against terrorism in the region and the world, the creators of Daesh and Al-Qaeda imagined that the resistance front would become weak. But they are wrong. The resistance front will never lose strength. The assassination of General Soleimani has injected fresh energy into the spirit of resistance among people of the region.
Moreover, head of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Brigadier General Ismail Ba'ani, said Soleimani was the hero of defeating arrogance.
General Soleimani was the man of resistance and logic. His path will continue. Those who assassinated him should be prepared for harsh revenge. General Soleimani was the hero of defeating arrogance. He is the hero of the Iranian nation and a hero of the Islamic Ummah.
A number of foreign dignitaries, including senior officials from Islamic Jihad, Iraq's Hashd al-Shaabi, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, as well as Yemeni ambassador, were among the participants at this event, who talked about different aspects of the personality of General Qasem Soleimani. One of the foreign dignitaries who attended the ceremony was Hashem Safieddin, senior official of Lebanon's Hezbollah, who said the resistance movement should continue the path of Soleimani. He also noted General Soleimani and assassinated Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes protected the world against the Daesh terror group.
Qasem Soleimani was a peaceful man because he became a general. He has been fighting for everyone. He has been fighting for humanity. Such people, we need them. Such people, there are few in this world.
General Qasem Soleimani was a man of resistance. His behavior and his beliefs taught the lesson of life. To all freedom seekers, he is a role model. He was a symbol of the fight against oppression. His name will remain in history forever.
General Soleimani, former commander of the IRGC Quds Force, was killed in a U.S. drone attack in Iwak on January 3, 2020.
On the first martyrdom anniversary of General Qasem Soleimani, senior Iranian officials have once again vowed to bring to justice the main perpetrators of his assassination in due time. According to Iranian officials, a lawsuit which has been filed in Iran against the U.S. for assassinating General Qasem Soleimani is in its final stage. And soon, a court session will be held in this regard. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
After dozens of civilians, including Ghadi's government officials, were killed and injured in the attack on Aden Airport, the deputy head of the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, Hani bin Barak, accused Qatar and Turkey of being behind it, ruling out that Sana'a was involved in it.
It's clear who's behind this latest attack in Aden Airport is the one who benefited the most from this attack, and is United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates and its forces in Aden, because United Arab Emirates doesn't want to be there a government which can actually express the term Yemen, or which can actually be in Aden. That's why United Arab Emirates, they want south of Yemen to be divided, all Yemen to be divided, so the United Arab Emirates can control Bab al-Mandab and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, and as well control Socotra Island. And
videos that went viral on social media showed that the missiles were launched from inside the Green City in Aden, which made observers accuse the SDC of seeking to push back Hadi's government to Riyadh hotels and fail the Riyadh agreement.
The Riyadh agreement implemented its objectives regarding the main interests of the Saudi and Emirati occupation authorities. Therefore, the Riyadh agreement formed this government to require it to implement the surrender of Yemeni sovereignty and not to administer any land controlled by the occupation forces.
The deputy head of SDC had preempted the arrival of the new Hadi government with a campaign to raise the flags of South Yemen in private and public facilities, including Aden International Airport, and he also warned members of the Hadi government not to talk about Yemeni unity, which confirms the continuing tension between the two parties to the conflict in southern Yemen.
There's no place for Hadi and his government in Aden. This is the message that the attack on the airport carried, meaning that Aden will continue to suffer under the rule of the militias of the UAE-backed SDC. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
We're back in the eye of the storm. These were the words of Simon Stevens, the head of Britain's National Health Service, as more people are in hospital with COVID-19 now than at the peak of the first wave earlier this year. Authorities are blaming the soaring infection rates on a new, more transmissible variant of the virus, first identified in Southeast England. Dr. Katie Sanderson of the Doctors Association has warned that the strain on hospitals is only going to get worse.
The volume of sick patients coming in with coronavirus is verging on unmanageable, just in terms of ambulance capacity, A&E capacity and bed capacity. We haven't seen the patients who had coronavirus infections that they've contracted over Christmas yet, because they're probably not sick enough to come to hospital yet.
Ambulances with infected patients have been forced to wait outside hospitals as capacity is overstretched. Many more infected individuals are forced to wait at home as ambulances are unable to meet the demands on the system.
This is something that we've just never experienced before. Control room staff are having to make incredibly difficult decisions to decide who gets an ambulance and in what order, quite often with huge numbers of people waiting for ambulances and they have nobody left to send.
A growing number of National Health Service staff are also off work because they are self-isolating or have become sick with the virus. Officials are now considering tightening coronavirus restrictions, with some suggesting a total nationwide lockdown to halt the spread of the new strain. Britain has recorded more than 71,000 confirmed coronavirus deaths, although some question the accuracy of the numbers when compared to mortality rates from previous years before the pandemic. According to the Office of National Statistics, the spike in fatalities for this year remains significantly higher than the government's official record of COVID fatalities.
This year will forever be remembered for the spread of COVID-19, but another, arguably more dangerous disease has spread rapidly too, hate. More specifically, hate against Muslims. Some of the most obvious examples can be seen in France, with the French President Emmanuel Macron pushing through anti-Islam legislation to prevent so-called Islamic separatism. In a later speech, the president condemned Islam as a religion in crisis, which radicalizes citizens.
Mais je demande à tout citoyen, quelle que soit sa religion.
And there is, in this radical Islam, since this is what the issue is, let's take it on board and let's name it. There is a will, a demand, an organized method to go against the laws of the Republic and create a parallel order based on the other values. Developing a separatist society first off with the goal of ultimately taking total control, and that's what they are doing, gradually, by rejecting the freedom of expression and freedom of thought.
Tensions in France additionally increased when the state publicly began defending insulting caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. The row spilled over into violence with attacks against journalists on the 25th of September, a teacher beheaded by a lone wolf takfiri on the 16th of October, and then on the 18th, two Muslim women wearing hijab were viciously stabbed by attackers screaming, "You dirty Arabs." Outside of France, things aren't much better, with numerous incidents of far-right Quran-burning protests occurring across Scandinavia. Between November 2019 and October 2020, at least four notorious Quran desecration rallies have been allowed, despite the fact that these protests offend millions. The Norwegian Prime Minister even publicly defended Islamophobes' rights to desecrate this holy book back in August. Then there is the Islamophobic ban on the Muslim niqab, a policy enforced by many countries, despite the fact that covering your face has been proven to save lives. Austria has also jumped on the bandwagon, punishing all Muslims for the acts of a small minority of criminals, introducing new laws intended to gag Muslims' freedom of speech.
In the fight against political Islam, the ideological basis behind it, we are going to create a criminal offence called political Islam, in order to be able to move against those who aren't terrorists but are preparing the ground for it.
Across the English Channel, a new conspiracy has been widely circulating, claiming that Muslims are somehow responsible for spreading the coronavirus. These ideas are not supported by any facts. However, the belief was so widespread it had to be debunked by a government fact-checker website. These are just a few examples, but studies suggest that Islamophobia is present at nearly all levels of society. Vaccines are being produced to stop COVID-19, but what is being done to defeat racism against Muslims?
Protests in Pakistan against Israel over its unending atrocities in occupied Palestine has not been so unusual. People in Pakistan have traditionally supported Palestinians in their struggle against Israel since 1948, when Israel killed and expelled Palestinians in a mass number and occupied their land. Many here rally behind leaders beyond Pakistan's borders over their support for Palestinians. One such leader is Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, a top Iranian commander who resisted against Israel and backed Palestinians at a time when many Arab rulers not only abandoned Palestinians, but also collaborated with Israel to suppress them. That is why many took to the streets in Pakistan after a U.S. drone assassinated General Soleimani in Iraq 1 year ago. Being victims of so-called war on terror, Pakistanis view the U.S. and its allies in a negative shade. Anti-U.S. and anti-Israel sentiments have been high in Pakistan for decades. So are some of the Arab rulers who have been under fire for normalizing their ties with Israel at the expense of the sufferings of the Palestinian people. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
After dozens of civilians, including Ghadi's government officials, were killed and injured in the attack on Aden Airport, the deputy head of the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, Hani bin Barak, accused Qatar and Turkey of being behind it, ruling out that Sana'a was involved in it.
It's clear who's behind this latest attack in Aden Airport is the one who benefited the most from this attack, and is United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates and its forces in Aden, because United Arab Emirates doesn't want to be there a government which can actually express the term Yemen, or which can actually be in Aden. That's why United Arab Emirates, they want south of Yemen to be divided, all Yemen to be divided, so the United Arab Emirates can control Bab al-Mandab and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, and as well control Socotra Island. And
videos that went viral on social media showed that the missiles were launched from inside the Green City in Aden, which made observers accuse the SDC of seeking to push back Hadi's government to Riyadh hotels and fail the Riyadh agreement. The deputy head of SDC had preempted the arrival of the new Hadi government with a campaign to raise the flags of South Yemen in private and public facilities, including Aden International Airport, and he also warned members of the Hadi government not to talk about Yemeni unity, which confirms the continuing tension between the two parties to the conflict in southern Yemen.
There is no place for Hadi and his government in Aden. This is the message that the attack on the airport carried, meaning that Aden will continue to suffer under the rule of the militias of the UAE-backed STC. Abdul Latif al-Washalib, Sana'a.
These days, Lebanon is hosting various events marking the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. This book reads, "The Man Who Vanquished America," will be out in bookstores on the martyrdom anniversary on January 3rd. The author tells Press TV he started writing after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, and the main inspiration for him was the personality of the man who changed the region and even the world.
This man is the man, in terms of strategy, is the man of the century. The United States could not beat him. On the contrary, he defeated the United States in many posts, in many positions, in many places, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine. So he outsmarted them.
One of the main discernments of deep study of the assassination of General Soleimani was that the will of the resistance will be more adamant on removing the U.S. hegemonic presence from the region.
Achieved nothing. They killed the freedom in their mind when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. They killed justice in their mind and in their people when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. On the contrary, Haj Qasem Soleimani now is living in every person or a thinker who think that Haj Qasem Soleimani represents such slogans, freedom, justice, and liberty.
U.S. Army generals and strategists, as well as those who grieved him, agree that the commander of the Quds force brought the people of West Asia together and made the cause of fighting U.S. oppression a united struggle. Other virtual events to commemorate the memory of the Iranian commander were held by a group of activists in the form of Lebanese traditional storytelling. Through this art form, the writers tried to narrate to the people of Lebanon the story of Commander Qasem Soleimani and his significant role in thwarting U.S. plots.
The biggest shock was when the U.S. Army General Petraeus read a message which read, "I am Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Al-Quds forces. I am the one who conducts the Iranian policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the entire region. And the Iranian ambassador in Iran is a member of the Quds force."
Many in the region who knew General Qasem Soleimani or learned about him after his martyrdom say they have no doubt that his martyrdom and the deeds done during his lifetime will lead to a complete liberation of the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Tour the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, my deen. Allah, my Lord. His word, Quran. Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, other life forms, how do you do? You're listening to Youth Station, only on IRIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for being with us.
I'm also here.
There's that guy, yeah. You know, my co-host.
I'm Mehdi, everyone, and I don't think she was planning on introducing me, and she was trying to just take everything for herself, so I was just trying
I was totally planning on doing a solo here,
you know, so
and you
I had to save
me.
Today for myself. What's up?
I'm Zainab. Sup is good. And everything is hunky-dory, alhamdulillah. Thank you so very much for being with us today.
Yeah, I broke your vibe, didn't I?
You know what? I'm used to it now.
Wow.
You know, after hosting this show for as long as I have, I'm used to my vibe being broken and myself not having any question to ask from, because no one cares about Zainab. Talking about caring is sharing is loving. Have you ever been in love?
I have no idea. I hope I've been in love.
You don't know whether you've been in love or not.
But you have to define what you mean by love, you know? Like, I have no idea what you mean by love. For example, someone says, I love Liverpool. So, I haven't experienced that kind of love.
Have you ever experienced any kind of love, you bitter, bitter man?
I think so. I'd like to think so.
Like, I recently fell in love. I fell in love yesterday, as a matter of fact. I fell in love yesterday with a black kitten. If you are asking, which you're not, because you never are. Yesterday, I was walking home from work, and then I saw a mama kitty with a baby kitty. They were both black, beautiful green eyes. They were playing with each other, and they were so fuzzy, and their fur looked so silky and cute. And they were just hopping around. There was a hole in the ground, and then suddenly the kitty went, whoop! It just fell into the hole, and my heart sank. And I rushed toward the kitty, while the mom was like followed immediately down the hole with this baby. I went there and I looked down from the hole, I looked up, down at the hole, whatever. And then I saw two green little eyes looking back up at me with its fuzzy fur. And at that moment, Billah al-Ali al-Azim, I was in love.
What did you do? Did you take it out, or were you just lost in that love and it just...
No, I didn't realize that the little hole was their home. It was their nest. It was where they hid from rain and whatnot because it's winter here. And yeah, I walked away. But subhanAllah al-Azim, yeah, I was in love yesterday.
I have no idea if it actually falls under a category.
If you guys could see the look on his face when he was looking at me as I was telling him my love story. Good God, you bitter man.
I have no idea what cute.
Do you even like cats?
I like animals generally. Cats.
No.
I've got three cats at my house, but they force their. They're like, I've got this basement where I keep my stuff, and these cats
you've invaded.
Invaded, and one of the cats had like
babies.
Yeah, kittens, and now everything that's there smells
like
happy? Cat. I have to be happy.
That was such a horrible tone for being happy.
You know, I have to keep myself happy because I can't do anything about it.
Okay, number one, I don't want to be you. You bitter, bitter man.
Do you want to know my opinion or do you want to know the...
Both. I want to know the official opinion and your unofficial opinion.
The official opinion, which is mine, I'll come up. Generally, there's Eros, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which relates to intimate... if you call it love, but you know, but yeah, things like that, that's Eros. The Greeks have defined it for us and we've just brought it down without question. That's something that's the first one.
Relationship. Romantic love?
Yeah, between two people, right?
And then the second type of love,
is
there is any?
Philia. Philia is
the love that is between siblings, between a mother and a child.
So a platonic